The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now with your host, Cascadia Weekly's. Cascadia Weekly's Jim Johnson, not in this week. He'll be back next time. But Dave Willingham from American Carnage Report and me, Stephanie Contouris. Today, we were recording today on National Coming Out Day. I want to let everybody know that I am queer, and that is a good thing. And whether or not you're out or ready to be out, there is support for you out there. And we're going to keep talking about it. Also this week, it was Indigenous Peoples Day in many parts of the nation. And here in Bellingham, it was Coast Salish Day. And I want you to know that we are coming to you live on Coast Salish land. So we are super excited that tonight we have members of the Lummi Nation who are about to embark on Kwelhoi. And we will be talking with them about their canoe journey. And also, that's senior correspondent Candace Wilson, and she'll be talking with Freddie Lane and master carver Jewel James. We also welcome special guests, Planning Commissioner Iris Monty Gibson and Clayton Petrie, two former candidates with insights and views on Bellingham. And a lot going on this week. We'll be talking about growth, accessory dwelling units, and our weekly Fergie Love Fest, as you have come to expect, and our pride in Washington's Attorney General grows ever stronger. But first, let's get into the local elections. Ballots are about to drop soon. First of all, welcome Clayton and Iris.
Thank you. It's nice to be here with you.
Thanks so much for having me again, Stephanie.
Absolutely. And it'll be really great to have your perspective as people who have been politicos in Bellingham. But first, let's go to Dave, and you can just give us a little look-see at where we are right now.
Well, we're a week out. Ballots are getting mailed next Wednesday. And it's kind of fun for me to go and look, having been on campaigns in the past, right now at where everybody is in the money race, because right now they're in just absolute burndown. And if because we're all in Whatcom County at large district, there's a lot of money sitting in that race ready to be spent on mailers and calls, and it's really going to be obnoxious for a couple of weeks here, and I'm really looking forward to it.
And both of you have been candidates. Iris, you ran for city council, and Clayton, you ran for city council, and you also ran for mayor in the Dan Pike-Kelly Linville race. So give us an insight of what it was like to be a candidate and dealing with the money issues at this point in the race.
Okay, well, for me, I felt pretty good going into this last part because I was the top money raiser out of all of the council candidates at the time. And, there's a lot of energy for every party. I think you'll feel like you have a chance and, you're figuring out how to best spend the last bits of money that you haven't already planned out that may come in at the end. And so it's a really exciting time for campaigns. How did you feel?
I agree. I actually, when I ran for city council, it was for an appointment. And so I didn't have to fundraise for my own bid for city council. But I've run many campaigns citywide, statewide, and including against Clayton. I should say for Pinky Vargas and for April Barker. And this is one of my favorite times in a campaign. It's when you have the chance to, for one, you finally are getting your pot of money together, and you're in some ways, if depending on where you're at, able to put down the phone and really start hitting the pavement. And if you haven't been already with a regular doorbelling plan, this is really the time to do so, because your mailers don't buy you votes, your yard signs aren't going to buy you votes. They may have gotten some awareness out there, but those one-on-one conversations are what's going to make people check the box, and this is the time to make that happen. And so I'm looking forward. I haven't seen anyone at my door yet, but I'm looking forward to having some conversations, hopefully this weekend, and getting out and pounding the pavement myself.
Yeah, I haven't gotten anybody at the door either, except for Bostrom, which I try to interpret as being maybe they're like, oh, we don't need to bother that person. But that doesn't stop with the mailers or anything. So maybe people just don't like me.
I just have to say, as a voter, as a former candidate myself, and as a former elected official in a political party, if somebody does not have their doorbelling game together by now, I'm super disappointed in them. And that's actually something that I look at in a candidate. I think one of the things we think about is, or people hear, well, how do you feel about the issues, even on issues where maybe a candidate would not have a lot of sway? And I think that happens a lot. We're going to get into accessory dwelling units in a second. But candidates from all sides get asked questions about where they stand. But really looking at how a campaign is run is sort of indicative to how you're going to hold office.
Absolutely. And one of the other great things about this time in the campaign, and Iris, you were talking about that, is there's the clarity of purpose where things just kind of snap into focus. And anytime you get a group of people together doing something, you get some interpersonal nonsense and things like that. And that's just inevitable. But now, all of that's kind of, if you're in a decent campaign, and I've been very lucky, all of that kind of falls away and you get to just race it out. It's great.
I'm really looking forward this election cycle to seeing what the impact of the last county election cycle, in which we determined how we would look at elections, and seeing how the new 5 fair and equal districts are going to help people clarify what it means to be a part of the North Bellingham district or a part of the Foothills district. And also interested in hopefully seeing that even though district-only voting passed, that people will still look and say, you know what happens in the Foothills is going to impact me. And so while I may not have the opportunity to vote for Rebecca Boonstra, I'm going to send a check her way, or I'm going to head out and doorbell for her and tell my friends in that part of the county to be sure to support her. And so I'm hoping that people still have the bigger picture in place that what happens in every part of Whatcom County is going to impact all of us. And I'm a little nervous about that part of the election cycle.
I think it's an excellent point. And it helps us transition into looking at the candidates themselves, especially when we look at the county candidates are in district only for the first time and in new districts for the first time. Meanwhile, we have the port, which is still 3 commissioners, and it's still anybody's game, and anybody can vote for any commissioner. So, Dave, how are we looking with some of the candidates?
Oh, just really quickly, we did have district-only voting, I think, for one cycle, and then the council switched it back soon after.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. How many years ago was that?
Oh, many.
Yeah. 10, I think. Right? Because it would have been with the last...
No, it was longer than that, I believe. But
Well, the new districts are for the first time,
yes,
anyway.
Yes, they are.
So there's something new.
It's hard to say. The money race has been generally kind of where I'd expect it. I've been seeing a lot more port yard signs this year than I remember seeing in previous elections. And that's maybe a good sign that people are starting to pay a little more attention to the fact that we have a port. They spend a lot of our money and they do important work. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that shakes out. It is strange that they are still on those weird pie-shaped districts through the county, but we collectively, I guess, decided a couple of years ago that we were going to stick with 3 port commissioners, and this is what we've got for now.
So we have 4 District 2, Mike McCauley is the current commissioner in that district, and Ken Bell is facing Barry Wenger in that race. And then in District 1, we have incumbent Dan Robbins, and he's facing Michael Shepard. And I think that they have sort of pretty clearly established some differences. And Michael McCauley was at the Leonard Streets neighborhood meeting last night, and he talked about, somebody asked a question about, do you prefer the development, if we develop it, they will come? Or do you prefer trying to solicit business and then developing, catering to the business? It was a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, and it's easy to forget that just how much economic activity happens down on that port. And it's not just maritime that's down there on the waterfront. There's a lot of tech down there. This is an important part of our county.
Well, and you can't forget that the port also runs the airport. And you know, in Seattle, the airport does a lot more dollars. It brings a lot more money in for the community than the seaport does. So they have an extremely important economic role in Whatcom County.
So any insights on those four candidates, anybody? No, we're just going to have to see how they're doing. And one of the things that is a little frustrating, I think we've talked about it before, is because these are Whatcom County races and not King County races and Bellingham races, we don't get polling. And we don't really have, even people when they have money coming from out of the state, from ALEC or something, not mentioning any names, they just don't put money into polling. So Dave made some astute points about money, but we don't always have a good idea of how successful people are being. So those are the port races. Then in the county, we've got Todd Donovan and Amy Glasser, and that goes right back to what you were saying, Iris. So just to remind people, Todd Donovan is in the current District 1. If he wins this election, he'll be elected to the new district, and council will appoint a replacement for an at-large post that will then not exist anymore with the November 2018 election. If Amy Glasser wins, then she and Todd will both serve. And that is probably, I think, the hottest candidate race in the county. I mean, Port's important, but I don't know if people pay as close attention.
Yeah, it's certainly the one that has captured the imagination of a lot of Bellingham. And, you know, it's half of the city. It's two fairly liberal people laying out, you know, slight variations, I think, on the same kind of ideological path. But, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of money raised there. I mean, combined, they're getting close to $50,000 raised, which is a lot for a within the city limits race. So it'll be interesting to see.
And that district that they're running for is particularly a new, very Bellingham-centric district, which it's really good, since we're on the radio, really good to take a look at a map online to see how different those districts are and how they reflect very different pockets of Whatcom County, I think.
Yeah, and I think maybe the most interesting part about that particular race with Todd and Amy is it's sort of a smaller version of the presidential issue that came up before. And I don't want to go too deep into that, but we all know the Bernie and Hillary issue. And what happened is Amy decided to run for council, and Todd is going to remain, whether he wins or loses, he has a seat for a couple more years. Well, it's been decided by the powers that be that maybe some people don't want Amy to be in there, so Todd can run for that, and then they can appoint whoever they feel like appointing.
Which will likely not be Amy. I mean, let's just be honest.
Yeah,
I don't think she'll be appointed yet.
It's really interesting to look at that. That happens within both parties in the county. I'm not trying to point something out about a specific party at all. But I think that's today politics and something that's we all need to deal with. And, I like things done on the up and up. And it's a little strange to me, that's all.
I hear
and
that.
Interesting.
I hear that. And we talked about that a lot before the primary. And it will definitely be interesting to see how that plays out. And then no matter who gets into what position, it's going to be fascinating to watch the county council operate in a completely different way than it has, A, when it's been balanced heavily conservative, and B, when it's been balanced heavily liberal.
I'm interested to see next election cycle, too, as we shake out what these different seats mean, if it in some ways can help make money less an aspect of Whatcom County politics. If people feel like, you know what, we're going to pour our energy into having this clarion voice that speaks for our part of the community and not spend all of our money trying to jostle for every piece of the pie.
Fantastic. You are listening. That was Iris Monte Gibson, and you're listening to her, Clayton Petrie, Dave Willingham, and myself on Cascadia News Now. We will be right back after this.
create, share, education. We enliven the rich history, legacies, stories, and historical traditions of the Salish people. We endeavor to create understanding and change perceptions across cultural differences, share history, and educate others. We are dedicated to marketing Native American-themed performance arts, as well as making the culture and the history of Native American people accessible. Drawing upon long family traditions, the children of the Setting Sun Productions, multimedia, film, and theater arts, specializing in Coast Salish storytelling. You will find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, or settingsunproductions.org. Heishka.
Cascadia News Now, welcome back. And Clayton Petrie and Iris Monty Gibson join us today. We've been talking about the elections, but we have some really interesting stuff coming up ahead. And one of the reasons I invited you, Iris, is because you are on the Planning Commission. And we want to talk about that because coming up on Thursday the 19th, the Planning Commission is going to really get into our current accessory dwelling unit regulations. And we'll talk more about that meeting coming up. But first, maybe you can just explain to me how a Planning Commission works, and don't you already have, we already have a City Council, and how does that all work together?
Absolutely. So the Planning Commission's role, it's one of the many boards and commissions that, a quick plug, that anyone can look on the City of Bellingham's website. There's many vacancies and ways that you can get involved, whether it's in watershed issues, arts and natural resources, and in the planning of our community. And the Planning Commission's role is to, it's advisory and it's regulatory. On the advisory side, we look at matters related to our City Council's implementation of the comprehensive plan, which was put together with feedback from the community and by our City Council to decide what Bellingham should look like, how it should grow, and how people should be able to interact with services and resources. And our role is to advise in the growth and in the zoning parts of that comprehensive plan. We're also regulatory in that we make recommendations regarding land use ordinances to City Council. Now, Council is ultimately making those decisions with the advice of both the Planning Commission and the expert research of the planning staff. And so it's a check and a balance, and it's also what I think of myself as a commissioner is also as an ambassador to the community. I'm on the ground as a renter, as a person who has lived in 7 different Bellingham neighborhoods, who's lived in Bellingham for 25 years, and who I think has the pulse of the millennial population and what our needs are particularly. And so I hope to bring that to the commission and add that voice where council sometimes can miss those opportunities.
So this ADU thing, the accessory dwelling unit, attached and detached, it has come up, as we were just talking about the elections, it's come up in the county race, it's come up in the city race, and it has come up somewhat in the port race, not as much. Clayton, you are a homeowner, and so I know you'll both have things to say about this. My very basic understanding is that it's about inevitable growth in Bellingham, and how do we handle it?
Yeah, I think you're a Birchwood Hoodian, aren't you?
I was. I grew up in the Birchwood neighborhood. I'm now in Leonard Streets.
Yeah, my house is in Birchwood, and I have a large lot like many of the other homes there do, and so that's definitely a topic of interest in that neighborhood. It's something that's been talked about for well over 20 years, and it's contentious because of that fear of the unknown. Many communities have had ADUs, and if implemented properly, they're a wonderful thing. I actually have lived in an ADU for the last year, and it's helped bring me an affordable place to live. And
what does that mean? You've lived in an ADU. Tell us sort of what that looks like.
Okay. Well, it's 50 square meters. I think that's about 500 square feet. So it's a little place. It's next to the main house, detached. And It just means that the people that own the house, it help the rent in, rental income helps them keep the place up, keep making their payments. And, you know, since it's not standalone on its own everything, they don't necessarily have to charge as large a rent fee as you might with standalone units. So that's what it means to me.
So attached and detached keeps coming up, and my understanding, you totally jump in and correct me, is that detached is something like a mother-in-law that are converted garage, and then an attached might be a separate entrance within the house, but it is its own. You're shaking your head. Tell me how I'm wrong.
Attached means it's literally attached to the main house, and right now I think they require a door that can be locked, but it has to have a passageway. Detached means it can be a completely separate unit, and they haven't decided all the requirements, but it's completely separate unit on the same property. So it's almost like a tiny home in some cases.
And right now, attached accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, are allowed in single-family homes. It's very in single-family zones. It's very hard to get one. And once we hit 20 in a single neighborhood, that's why this is being brought up again for to revise the ordinance. Detached ADUs right now are only allowed in multifamily zone neighborhoods and are also really incredibly hard to actually legally get zoned.
Fiscally difficult to make happen because you're building a lower density than multifamily, and that land is expensive. So it doesn't make good financial sense to buy this expensive piece of property and not build it out with an apartment on it. So
where are we? You know, you talked about the situation with that. Where are we with the process? Where is the council and the commission in?
So the commission, what our process will be is that we'll hold several work sessions to bring ideas forward, ask questions of staff, send the staff back to do some more research, solicit community feedback, and then the staff will come up with a draft ordinance based on the Planning Commission recommendations. That ordinance will then go to City Council in the coming months. There'll be another public hearing, opportunity to revise that ordinance, and then City Council will vote on that. We had a public hearing on the initial work session a few weeks ago. I was so pleased to see that people came out from the Birchwood neighborhood who were young families. We had people from the Sunnyland neighborhood who had their mothers who they wanted to have them move into their backyard. We had people from the South Hill neighborhood who had students who'd lived in their ADUs for decades and had positive experiences. And I have to say, I think that was a really unique surprise compared to what's often been that not in my backyard voice that is reverberated across our community anytime that density has been brought up. And so I was really pleased to see new voices coming forward, and I hope at the work session next week we'll have some more voices come forward to share what an ADU might mean to them and additional housing options might mean for them.
Well, that's an interesting point. I have definitely noticed a overall change in the tone of letters to the editor that I have seen regarding ADUs and other density proposals. Do you have any idea what's going on with that? Is Bellingham just changing? Is there a movement happening?
You know, the issue is one that I've thought about for a long time and was first brought to my attention in Todd Donovan's local politics class at Western. And he talks a lot about there's empirical evidence that ADUs and that denser housing will make neighborhoods more diverse, will provide more housing options, will reduce housing prices and increase stock. And yet, when it comes to asking people what they want in their own neighborhoods and in their own backyards, over and over again, the social science tells us that people are going to say not in my own backyard or in my own neighborhood. And so I think it's taken time for people to realize that everyone in Bellingham, every neighborhood needs to take on some responsibility and some of the burden for making our neighborhoods more livable and more affordable.
I want to bring up a word, and that word is character, because that is the word that I hear a lot, particularly on the side of people who are very concerned about increasing the number of ADUs. So talk to me about neighborhood character, and is it something that is preservable?
I absolutely think it is. And I think that one of the things that's been interesting with the process that I'd like to hear from you all and from others is that, especially coming from the dispute resolution center and my mediator background, character is brought up as the issue, but what's the underlying interest? Because we know there's ADUs, a smattering, really nicely dispersed throughout Bellingham right now. And like I said, I've lived in many Bellingham neighborhoods, and I don't see how having an ADU and bringing a more diverse population in any way hinders neighborhood character. So I'm interested in trying to get into what that underlying interest is.
Well, I see two things. One is the Washington State growth law requires that character be considered and preserved. And that's not to say ADUs can't be part of this neighborhood character. It doesn't mean things don't change. I think the big fear is, you know, some junky units being thrown up, and not literally thrown up, but tossed in the backyard and, you know, having problems with that. And I just don't see our planning commission, the Bellingham's Planning Commission, doing that. They're thoughtful. I know all of these people. They're thoughtful, and they're going to come up with a great set of regulations. It just has to be done right. And most of the ADUs in town now are pretty nice. There's some that aren't, and they've been sort of pointed to as, well, this is the problem. But we don't have to allow that to happen. So as long as they do things carefully, it's not going to hurt the character.
So you're talking about, Clayton, how you know everybody on the Planning Commission, and Iris, it sounds to me like you may have some strong feelings about ADUs and where you think the city should go. So I'm curious to know, do you feel like those multiple viewpoints are represented on the current Planning Commission?
I do. I've really enjoyed, I've been serving on the Planning Commission since April, and I really enjoy the thoughtful approach that is brought to the commission by a number of members. I think there's been an evolution in my thinking thanks to the expertise that's been brought by some of the developers, which is a new sort of industry for me to interact with. And I really feel like people are bringing forward some different ideas and different thoughts. And we've had some contentious conversations and some challenges to challenging conversations.
So I just want to remind people, this is going to be obviously an ongoing conversation for some time. Nothing's going to happen overnight. However, it's getting started with the Planning Commission. And again, that meeting is Thursday, October 19th at 7 p.m. And that is going to be looking at recommendations from city staff and the commissions, and also a proposal by the Happy Valley Neighborhood Association. Again, that is at 7 p.m. at City Council Chambers. And I just want to remind people, spoken comment may be accepted at the meeting, but you can submit written comments now to planningcommission@cob.org before October 17th. You can also look at the current regulations and a lot more information at cob.org. You are listening to Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham and 102.5 KAVZ Deming Van Zandt. And we are going to move on now. There was some exciting news in terms of economics, and our own, or the 40th's own, state senator Kevin Ranker wrote an opinion piece in the Everett Herald this week, and it concerned where we are with the economic situation. Dave?
Yeah, it was, it was somewhat celebrating that, you know, our tax receipts are somewhat higher than expected, to the tune of about $500 million, which is good news. It doesn't necessarily address all of the need and imbalance in the current budget, But as I won't shut up about on the show, we have a long way to go in that regard anyway. But it was nice to see more talking about it because, again, I'm not going to shut up about this. We talk about this a lot while the legislature is in session, and we have a part-time legislature who managed to have repeated overtime sessions. And when they're not in session, we forget a lot about what they were doing and what's going on. And this is the time we need to be thinking about it because when they're back in it, things are going to be happening too quickly. So if we want to have change in how our state's revenue is generated, how we raise and spend money, we have to start that process before it's on everybody's minds.
So when you say start that process, I mean, our legislators are off doing non-legislative things. How do we as citizens start that process?
Well, you know, we can, you know, form groups. We can talk about it amongst our friends. We can recruit people into things. We can write letters. Our legislators are legally required to live among us. So, you know, find out where they're going to be. They don't just sit idle during this time. There are still committees holding hearings. And some worthwhile legislators are still having town halls and things. Our own Doug Erickson is going to be speaking up at Western, I believe, next week. And, you know, reach out and, you know, make your voice heard.
Well, one thing I wanted to bring up about that op-ed is that Kevin Ranker, as he had been before, Senator Ranker was talking a lot about property tax. And that reminds me of the situation with the chicken. Look up Kevin Ranker and chicken on YouTube if you haven't seen that, when he was confronted somebody who was protesting taxes with the chicken. That's all I can say about that. But but he's talked a lot about property tax and who's going to be affected by it, and I think that he mentioned that in his article as well.
Yeah, and one of the, you know, features of living in Washington State is that every election year we get on our ballots the opportunity to say, you know, oh, we like this tax increase or we don't like this tax increase whenever the legislature passes something new. And this year, everybody in the state is going to see, oh, there's this new almost $13 billion tax increase on their ballot next to the other candidates, which, you know, none of the few of the legislative positions are going to be up this year. But that's probably going to be a surprise to a lot of people.
Well, I hope it's not a surprise because we've all, well, at least all the people in this room have known about it for quite some time. I didn't get to spend a lot of time on the column, but I think, you know, it's a mistake for any government to have an overly optimistic guess as to how much tax is going to increase. He talks about unrealistic healthcare savings assumptions. Our own governor actually, when he was running the first time, said, we're going to pay for all our school stuff with healthcare savings. So it's something that seems to happen over and over and over. And it's because it's difficult to propose new taxes in Washington State. We're a very liberal state, and we care about our education because it's extremely important. But it's still hard to pass new taxes.
Thanks a lot, Tim Iman.
Well, and the voters turn it down sometimes, well, often as well. So I'm just going to leave it at that. You know, I would like us not to be so optimistic about how much some new program, unknown new program is going to save us, about unknown new taxes. And, you know, the more realistic we are going into it, the less we run into these kinds of things later. But I want to thank people from both parties that have been working on this stuff and ask them to cooperate with each other and figure it out, because it's time.
And we have to move on, but maybe for another show sometime. One thing that strikes me, because we are the most regressive tax state, meaning we are the most punitive to people who can afford it the least. In my heart, I am very adamantly in favor of a state income tax, which is a hard sell. It's a story for another time. Sometimes I find myself thinking, oh, yeah, property tax. Well, that's for people who have homes and money, and shouldn't that be great? But I forget to think about how that's going to impact everyone who pays rent and how that impacts people trying to find places to live.
For so many people, my parents included, they bought their house with cash. It's their main asset. and to say this is the thing that they're going to be taxed so highly on, it just is so backwards to me.
Absolutely. So we'll talk about that more. But meanwhile, we have to get into our Fergie Love Fest, as we do pretty much every week, because Attorney General Bob Ferguson is doing something fantastic every single week. What is he doing this week, Dave?
Well, this week, there's been a couple of things. But one of the top line items is filing suit against the federal government over their attempts to weaken the mandate that insurance companies, as part of what you're paying for with them, cover contraception. And I think this is a good move. I don't know that they're going to get super successful. I haven't read all the way through the filing yet, but I think, you know, it's good to make the attempt. This is important in a way that, you know, it's hard to put into words, because the basic disparities in health care aren't just who gets it and who doesn't have it. It's what you get from it. And if you're paying for it, it should, you know, provide you health care. And when there's a lot of basic things that are not included, or where someone in between you and your medical provider gets to say, well, not that thing, that's a problem.
Yeah, I just want to point out there's been a lot of raging back and forth. And one of the arguments that I hear over and over again is, but I use birth control for endometriosis, or I use birth control for this pain reason, and I use birth control for that pain reason. And that's all very valid. But at the end of the day, we shouldn't have to have that argument. We should be able to say, hey, healthcare is comprehensive, and it is not the employer's role to decide which kinds of health care you can get when. That is between you and your medical staff and your medical professionals. And I just, that's just something that irks me.
Absolutely. The religious liberty argument used over and over again to take away people's basic needs is really despicable.
And I want to throw in one more thing while we're in our, you know, worshiping our attorney general session here. there was an announcement this week, you know, kind of a weird mirror to the previous one. The state attorney general has secured $3 million from the Department of Justice to start processing the state's sexual assault kit backlog, which right now is at about 6,000, which is a deep shame to all of us here and all over the country, where the backlogs are gigantic and there are thousands of people waiting for justice until we can get the money to get all of this processed. And this is a step in the right direction, and I hope, you know, once we clear that out, it never grows again.
You know, there was a question on Reddit the other day. If your state had royalty, who would it be? And some people said Bob Gates for Washington State. But man, I think Attorney General Bob Ferguson, you are at least our Lancelot. So we will have more of that coming up on another show. But we have just a couple minutes left. And Clayton, I know you wanted to connect about bicycles and bicycle theft, which is a huge issue in Bellingham.
Yeah, it's a big issue. I've lived in Bellingham for a long time, and my first brush with bicycle theft was when I was about 7. Saved up for a long time and put a new seat and handlebar and grips on my bike, which was promptly stolen that night. And I still remember it, seeing it in the auction later on. So maybe that's why I want to talk about it now. But we have a big bicycle theft problem in Bellingham, and I just want to say that please register your bike with the Bellingham Police Department. It helps them tremendously, not only when they find the bike to get it back to you, but also to deal with these people that are stealing the bikes. So please register your bike, talk to the BPD, and that'll help them quite a bit and help them curb this problem that is plaguing Bellingham.
Just really fast, does registering your bike help if your bike is taken apart into pieces and sold in pieces?
Well, you'll at least get the frame back, and it also helps them to get the people that are taking the bike, the person found with this bike that is not theirs, they can then pursue them legally, whereas if they don't have this registration, they can't do it. So it makes a big difference.
Thank you for that PSA. We might have to get you to record that, actually. Moving on, I just want to say a huge thank you to our senior correspondent, Candace Wilson. She sat down with Freddie Lane and Jewel James to talk about the upcoming Lummi Quelhoy Totem Journey.
This is Candace Wilson from Lummi Nation. And I have Freddie Lane here. He is a cultural ambassador of Lummi Nation. And he has an upcoming event that he will be journeying on. And we're going to find out what that journey is all about. So, good afternoon, Freddie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good.
Tell me about the Totem Journey.
Well, since 2002, I've been traveling with Jewel James and the House of Tears Carvers. It began back in, again, 2002 with the Healing Pole Journey that went to the survivors and the families of the victims of 9/11. And so over the years, I think this will be my ninth Totem Pole Journey traveling with Jewel. And the journey is called Quelhoy, We Draw the Line. And this journey is very special because it's going to be a traveling museum exhibit with videos, of course, that I made because I'm the videographer on the journey. And it's going to feature Jewel's totem pole. You can also find out about all of our upcoming stops at Our Shared Responsibility on our Facebook page. Our Shared Responsibility, A Totem Pole Journey. And that has all the stops and all the places and people we'll be standing with, from the Sierra Club to those fighting Kinder Morgan up in Vancouver. On Friday the 13th, we'll be in Vancouver. Saturday, October 14th, we'll be in Seattle. And then in Tacoma on Sunday, October 15th. Down near the Foss Sea Waterway. And then on Monday, we'll be in Vancouver, USA. And then Tuesday, October 17th, I believe, we'll be in Portland, Oregon. Again, this is with the Quelhoy. We Draw the Line. It's our Lummi Totem Pole Journey for 2017. It's going to be a lot of, I mean, you know, the power behind this journey, and I can't even say power, but the sacredness that comes with this journey is that all the way across in our West Coast tour, from Portland, we just head straight to Pittsburgh, and Quelhoy will be a traveling art museum exhibit for the next 3 years. Again, its first stop is at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, which is like the fifth most prestigious museum in the country.
Wow.
And it'll stay there, I believe, for 6 months, and then it travels to Princeton, New Jersey, where it'll be on display there for another 6 months. And so this is really kicking off this, I guess it's, you'd call it an experimental movement. You know, people think of museums, when you walk into a museum, you see these different objects of dead culture, so to speak. But, you know, we've been here for the last 5,000 years, since the Great Flood here at Lummi. And so we're,
time immemorial.
Yeah. So we've got a long way to go with our upcoming journey. This will be a lot of it. The great thing about this journey too is that it opens up with a museum curators conference in Pittsburgh, and it's going to be a pretty remarkable moment to stand with you know, all these museum curators and directors from museums from throughout the world. And so it's really gonna be a a challenge to do this. And wow, wouldn't you just know, here is Master Carver Jewel James himself.
Well, hello, Jewel. It's great to see you. If we have the chance, the opportunity here to share about the upcoming Totem Journey.
Well, I'm glad that you're able to meet with Fred Lane. You know, Fred really does a lot of coordination, a lot of video recording and audio recording of our journeys. You know, and I'm not sure exactly how much he was able to give you in regards to information, but we really look forward to finishing the pole. We're hollowing it out right now. And then we're fixing a cover plate so that after it's hollow, that the plate will fit perfectly, so you'd never know that there's a hollow spot. But the idea of hollowing the log is to make sure it doesn't crack as much. You know, pressure's all in the heart. But it's all painted. We've had some great painters. There are really dedicated young ladies that came here day after day, even in the rain, working. You know, so we look forward to going up into Vancouver, then Seattle, Tacoma, and then down Vancouver, Washington area, and then into Portland. And then myself and my brother Doug and brother Fred Lane here will be heading to Pittsburgh. And then there'll be another gathering there outside in Pittsburgh for all the activists, local activists.
October 23rd. Yeah,
yeah. That's the and then date then there. We'll spend a couple of days getting everything into the Carnegie Museum, where the Anthropocene Conference is taking place. And we'll have a presentation along with several other prominent tribal leaders from across the country, Sioux Nation, Tsleil-Waututh Nation, people coming from all over to participate in the idea that we have to be activists to save the world. The world's dying around us, and mankind is extremely destructive. And so we will do a presentation, but the totem pole and all the other artifacts that have been shared, including some by Fred Lane and others, will be on display at the Carnegie Museum for several months. It'll go to Princeton and Harvard and several other museums. I believe it's going to be on tour for a minimum of 3 years. And then the pole will come home to Orcas Island. It'll be raised over at the museum or the library at Orcas Island. And so helping work with the people of Orcas Island for saving the salmon, saving the whales.
What's all on the totem pole again? I know the beautiful top has the Indian in the moon.
Well, we have a 9-foot bear on the bottom, and it has various signs of the salmon. As you know, the Lummi Nation is extremely concerned about their ability to prevent further damages to the various stocks of salmon coming through the different rivers. We have some, like the Chinook, are endangered, the Hood's Canal Chum are endangered, and some of the silver salmon are endangered. And we're having problems because the state and the federal governments are trying to defund the hatchery operations, at the same time prop up Atlantic salmon net pens. You know, and so this is all a concern for us. And the thing about the bear is that it symbolizes part two of the salmon story, salmon woman story, where bear went in and damaged the salmon and as a consequence changed their life patterns forever and changed their relationship with the salmon as well as the spawning habitat. Above the bear is four human beings. They're 3 feet tall. Two are kneeling and the other ones are squatting on the right and the left, symbolizing the four races, you know. And yeah, they're painted, you know, the skin's all the same because we're all same, really. We're all brothers after all. And we just kind of distinguish the red, black, white, and yellow by the way they painted their face. But the whole idea is that mankind has been very destructive to the habitat of the bears, the habitat of the salmon, and all the other species. You know, so the Indian in the Moon, it talks about harmonies. You know, it tells a story, and you know, we've included that image before on the National Library of Medicine poll, and in that case it was a medicine woman, and that's an Algonquin myth. But the late Vi Hilbert, treasurer of the tribes here in the Pacific Northwest, she had 96 different star child myths that attached to it. And so we use some different symbols, but those symbols have myths tied to them. And they have a message to our to us about what is the relationship we have with the world around us. We're hoping to cause a unity of voice, unity of spirit, and unity of commitment to action by going on this journey.
And protecting all of our sacred sites and Kuchikin, and reminding of the black snake, the the Kinder Morgan pipeline. That's a big battle up in Vancouver. And then even the LNG one that's trying to be proposed here, just bringing that awareness is really, really a powerful movement.
Well, we just really encourage the public to really pay attention to some of the announcements. I know they're having a gathering in Seattle tomorrow to raise awareness and raise funding to help the people up that are being hurt along the Kinder Morgan pipeline and the tar sands, help them continue their battle and help them stand up and continue to advocate the stopping of the destruction of the earth and the severe damage that those pipelines will have, not just to the land and the peoples that are along the route, but also to the streams, the creeks, and the Fraser River system. But yeah, you know, we've worked with the Dakotas, the Sioux, and they're concerned about the Missouri River. You know, and we work with the Columbia River tribes, and they're concerned about the Columbia River. You know, and you know, wherever we go, there's Friends of the Earth or there's river protectors, citizens that are standing up and uniting across all racial boundaries. We all know that if we don't unite, if we don't work together, then we're basically authorizing them to continue their activities that are damaging the world around us. Problem with corporations is that they're greedy. They don't have real values like a human being. They're an artificial entity, and because of that, they can come in and conduct activities that are extremely destructive to the air, the water, and the land. And they're going to go home. They're going to leave. They're going to go to another state or another country. They're just going to reap the rewards of profit and leave the Superfund sites to the citizens that have to live in the aftermath of their activity. And so our advocacy is for us to all unite in our voice and hold the politicians accountable that are advocating relaxing the regulations, you know, and the controls. You know, and we're living in a time where Trumpism is out of control. You know, and they're doing everything to basically destroy the world around us. You know, so if they're not taking up all the wealth they can, they're destroying everything behind them, you know, and that's unacceptable. You know, and we believe that the people have to stand up and advocate best interest for the next generations. You know, this environment's been loaned to us. It's on loan to us. We don't own it. You can't own it. It's owned by future generations, and our duty is to protect what we have around us and leave it in a better status than when we found it. Otherwise, we're cheating the future generations.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Joel. That's phenomenal. So who can help? Who is going to protect Mother Earth? And how can they get in touch with the journey, the totem journey, Quel Hoy, our shared responsibility, our sacred obligation?
Freddie? The journey has had our shared responsibility, a totem pole journey, and that's our Facebook page. We'll carry events live, and people can also participate if they want to donate at totempolejourney.com. And, you know, okay. That always helps Jewel out. You know, these are big undertaking.
Definitely.
Gas is real, you know, just events for our hosts sometimes, you know, it tends to be a lot. And I'm not saying that this isn't a thankless job, but, you know, even at home, you know, it's tough to get support from even our own tribe. And so I really applaud Jewel and Uncle Doug and the House of Tears Carvers for this effort, just to educate. I remember Winona LaDuke, when I first met her and interviewed her, and I remember she said, "You Lummi people, you are world renowned as earth keepers. You guys are known throughout the whole universe as keepers of Mother Earth. You guys stand up for the salmon and for the four-legged creatures and the insects that have no voice, for our relatives that fly the skies. You know, we all remember that we were once animals, you know, us, you know, us human beings, and we come from the different clans. I come from the Eagle Clan, you know, and so we have to remember these things and remember where we come from and remember that we are survivors of the Great Flood.
We all are.
We are, and I always remember that, you know. know where you come from. And so this isn't just a Lummi effort. This isn't just a Tulalip or a Swinomish or a Sioux effort. This is all of our communities coming together. And I think that's the real spiritual power of protecting our earth, because, you know, you just became a grandma, you know, Jules, you know, we all have future generations, nephews and nieces and families that are going to come, and how are they going to look at us? We're the first generation to recognize global climate change, and we're the last generation that can do something about it.
Thank you for the time today, the messages that these journeys carry for our people. It's about protecting Mother Earth and doing our part moving forward for generations to come. So, Haishka, thank you, ma'am, both for your time today. And thank you, Brother Doug, for the journey, the work that you guys do. Please be safe, be careful, and know that you're in our hearts while you journey. Haishka.
That was Candace Wilson speaking with Freddie Lane and Master Carver Jewel James. They are embarking on the Quehoy totem pole journey. There are going to be a lot of events around that, so do follow Freddie's links and look for them on Facebook, and help send them on and really support this effort. It's important for the nation of Lummi Nation and for the planet as well. A huge thanks to Candace Wilson for getting us that interview and having that conversation this week. Also, huge thanks to Clayton Petrie and Planning Commissioner Iris Maudie Gibson for the fantastic conversation, and to my co-host Dave Willingham, who has all of the information that we could ever want and more, and some hot passion about what's happening in the state and in our elections. You have been listening to Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contours. Tim Johnson will be back next week. And I want to remind you that if you have anything to say, if we have irked you, if we have pleased you, if you have something that you want to get off or on your chest, please share it with us. You can find us on the Facebooks, Cascadia News Now or CascadiaNewsNow.com. You have been listening to us on KAVZ 102.5 in Deming, Van Zandt, and KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham.